Hello, everybody. Bill Buckmaster with you, along with my friend Tom Fairbanks, engineering and producing our program on the other side of the glass. And we wish you a very happy solstice. This is the first day of winter. And Tom, it is Wednesday, December 21st, 2022. And, you know, we are so fortunate to be able to be looking at our weather forecast, 77 degrees within the next week or so, temperatures around 70, and the rest of the country just having one of the most, look at the Denver, Colorado.
Have you seen the weather map that shows the whole of the United States?
Yes.
It's everything is covered in that cold temperatures and snow, except the little bit over here in the southwest.
The little bit of southwest, that is about the only place, and boy, are we going to enjoy it. We have a lovely holiday season coming up weather-wise. The Buckmaster Show, celebrating 12 full years already with our radio project at the end of the year. Then we'll begin Lucky 13. 35 years on television and radio here in town. I came to town the first week of January back in 1988 over at KUAT Channel 6 and thrown right into it. The then governor was Evan Meekum, who was about to be recalled, and that was one of my first interviews over at Channel 6. The Buckmaster Show, we are broadcasting from the Green Thing Zocalo Village Studio. We're so proud that they have the naming rights to our studio during the Buckmaster Show, and of course, we're broadcasting also from the Bustos Media Broadcast Complex, where we have four radio stations, including the one you're listening to, 1030, Tucson's Voice for Trusted News Talk, KVOI, worldwide live listening on my website, buckmastershow.com. I'm very proud of the fact that just about every show we have done on the radio is very conveniently archived at buckmastershow.com. When we do our telephone interviews, that's presented by our friends at Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. All right, joining me in studio, newly minted Fulbright Scholar, Dr. Albrecht Clausen, University Distinguished Professor, Director of Outreach at the Department of German Studies at the University of Arizona. And before I continue on with your outstanding bio, the day you got word, I think this was about the day you got word back in August, you were with me in studio when the news came about the Fulbright Scholarship.
That's so true. Thank you, Bill, for mentioning this. That was the highlight of my life.
Well, we're going to hear all about that, probably in our segment two with you. And we are going to do a kind of a two-day interview with you. We're going to spend a half hour with you today, and then a week from tomorrow, we'll be bringing you back. There's so much on the plate to discuss, and I want to talk about a little bit and let our listeners know something about you. You are now the editor-in-chief of a worldwide online journal. It's the Humanities Journal. You have a broad range of research interests covering the history of medieval and early modern German and European literature and culture, spanning about 1,000 years, from 800 to 1800. And of course, you also write contemporary literature, you write poetry and prose, you've published hundreds of scholarly articles and book citations, translations, textbooks, including a handbook of medieval studies. And you've won many honors, of course, not only the Fulbright, you are the Grand Knight Commander of the Most Noble Order of the Three Lions in recognition of outstanding services to German studies, and you are the newest member, I believe, of the five-member Arizona Humanities Board of Directors. One of your most recent books is titled Wisdom from the Middle Ages, and the most recent is The Secret in Medieval Literature. Always a pleasure, Professor, to welcome you back to the program.
Thank you, Bill, for having me on the program. It's always a pleasure.
Well, here we are. The winter season has begun, and you grew up in post-World War II Germany. What are some of your memories of that period?
Well, that's a very good question, and would really require a lengthy discussion. But let me highlight just a few things. There's a big difference between American and German culture, and I don't need to talk really about the difference between then and today, but rather the general practice. Germany is predominantly a Christian country. Of course, there's also Jewish and Muslim communities, but the Christians celebrate very much the four Advents, the four Sundays before Christmas. They celebrate the children, at least they celebrate very much the arrival of Saint Nicholas, really, who comes on the 6th of December. So very different from American culture, where Santa Claus is associated with Christmas, which is completely wrong in theological religious terms. Saint Nicholas was just a bishop who arrives on December 6th and punishes evil children and rewards the good ones. So we always got some little gifts and waited really very anxiously for the arrival of December 6th, then celebrating the four Sundays before Christmas with a lot of wonderful baked goods, Stollen, for example, which you can get at, let's say, Trader Joe's or other places, or Lebkuchen, and many other particular types of sweets for that season. So it was always a very season for the sweet tongue.
But was your community in a period of reconstruction after the war, or was it spared the devastation that so many of the big cities of Germany experienced?
Well, I was born 56, so you can
know.
Well,
yeah, there you go. Okay.
And so at that time, I was not really that much aware as a kid about the destruction, although since then I've learned that virtually every town was basically destroyed, bombed, burned down. So, but I did not quite realize that, and only learn in the course of time the history of Germany and the devastation. But you wouldn't really notice much today about all those things. That's now almost 80 years ago, and so things have really changed dramatically.
One of the myths of the Middle Ages, Dr. Clausen, is about the fact that certainly it was just such an absolute bleak time. We have these visions of, and I can only think that, well, if you go along with the myth, winter must have, if the whole year was usually one of hardship, winter must have been especially difficult.
Well, it all depends on whom you're asking and whom you're really talking about. I mean, let's say you look at our own world, and I would say talk to a homeless person whose life is completely different from our lives, for example. So the same thing in the Middle Ages, if you look at noblemen or noble ladies, or if you look at the life of merchants or students or farmers, all that depends. But what we can tell certainly from our evidence, they enjoyed their seasons as well. They had hygiene, much higher than we would assume normally. They celebrated the feasts as they came, ate and drank, were jolly. So all depends a little bit on your perspective. You can always have a negative view. Oh my goodness, everything was bad and cold in the past. But at the same time, well, it's a very diverse situation.
What would surprise our listeners about wisdom from the Middle Ages about your one of the most recent books? Give us a couple of tidbits that might even go along with the winter season.
So you mentioned that I'm researching the Middle Ages in general, and one of the major reasons, at least presently for me, for studying this time period, is that it has so much wisdom to tell us, talking about fundamental concerns in human life, friendship, trust, honor, for example, quest for spirituality, tolerance, all these things you would normally not associate with the Middle Ages. You would think it's all the Dark Ages, barbaric, primitive, when in reality, really, it was a very sophisticated world, at least certain sections. Very curious world with lots of travel, with lots of cultural contacts.
But why do we say, and I know you don't like this term, you know where I'm going with it. I think we've brought it up on past conversations. Yep. I know you hate the term, the Dark Ages. Uh-huh. Where in the world did that come from?
Very easy. Whenever you have a new period coming or new thinkers, they try to put down the previous age. So basically, the 14th century, the Italian Renaissance, they wanted just to put down everything that happened before. So Petrarch, for example, called everything prior to him Gothic, barbaric, dark, because they wanted to return to the classical Roman
age of enlightenment.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of enlightenment already in the Middle Ages. It all depends on whom you study, what sources you draw from. And I find always exciting, really, that's one of my major motivations to study that time period, that I can defy those myths and show people how much the past allows us to understand the present and go into the future.
When we continue with Dr. Claussen, he'll have some great information about his recent trip over to Egypt. He's been on sabbatical, all part of a research project. We'll hear all about that. One of the things that we know, Dr. Claussen, is not a myth, is Mona's Danish Bakery. They have some of the most beautiful pastries, European-style pastries and breads. They're the home of the Danish Kringle. And Kringle kind of goes with Christmas, so it would be beautiful for your Christmas Eve morning or Christmas morning to have a beautiful Kringle. Check it out. Mona's Danish Bakery, Northeast Corner, Swan and Sunrise. We'll be ordering a beautiful pie from Mona's for our dessert on Christmas Day, and I suggest you might think about that. Got some beautiful pies at Mona's Danish Bakery. Their website, monasdanishbakery.com. We continue with Dr. Albrecht Claussen right after this. Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com. Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com.
Delivering a $2 billion voter-approved regional transportation plan involves complex policy, legal, and financial matters. The Regional Transportation Authority is open to answering any questions you have about delivery of the current RTA 20-year plan or about the development of a new regional transportation plan for the next 20 years. Contact the RTA at info@rtamobility.com.
Family-owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show. We continue now with our conversation with Fulbright scholar Dr. Albrecht Clausen, University Distinguished Professor, Director of Outreach in the Department of German Studies at the University of Arizona. We were talking about the season of light, the winter season. You growing up in post-war Germany, there were a lot of celebrations going on in some more that people might be surprised, still very diverse communities.
Yeah, and that's part of my own activity as the Director of Outreach. I normally organize then events for our students or the community, trying to bring the German customs of the seasons, Advent in the Christian sense, bringing in German baked goods that are very typical of the season, and little cookies and so forth, Lebkuchen, of course. All that has a lot to do with the German industry, baking industry, so very much with Nuremberg, a whole industrial component where they were specialized. Until today, the typical type of food of that that season. But we also know, of course, other cultures do it too. Hanukkah in Jewish studies or Jewish
Hanukkah
cultures.
Hanukkah is known as the season of light.
Exactly. Yeah. And after all seasons, all cultures, all religions share, in essence, the celebration of the change of the seasons. After all, it is solstice today, or the December 21st, mm-hmm. June 21st. So it's just simply the way how this, the earth circles around the sun. So people have always realized the change of the season, crucial change. So the celebration, very pagan originally, then transformed to religious, Christian, Jewish, whatever, customs.
Your last name, Clausen, is that like Santa Claus?
Yeah, well, I divulge that to you, right? So it's an old Mennonite name.
Really?
So originating from probably the Frisian area, Friesland, northern Germany, northern Holland, where the Klaus would be Klaas, and then Sohn would be Sen. So Klaassen. So it's one of those typical names like Fredriksen, Johansen, Johnson, and so forth.
It kind of sounds like Santa Claus.
That's right. I like to think that I bring a lot of goodies to our students and the public with my research. So.
There you go. You've been traveling since we last saw you. We last saw you and visited with you on the show in August. You had just been named that day. The news had just come in. You being honored as a Fulbright scholar. You then took off for Egypt. Mm-hmm. What was the motivation to go there?
Fulbright was a senator, and he endowed a scholarship, one of the highest ranking scholarships at all that the U.S. government gives. So for me, it was a huge accomplishment to be appointed as a Fulbright scholar. I had developed a working relationship with a colleague at Cairo University for about 6 years or so. And so my proposal, my project was, how can I, as a Germanist, teach medieval literature at an Arabic university? And that was an extremely interesting experience because I was diving into a different culture, had to work with Copts, Muslims, students from different backgrounds, and suddenly teaching them some medieval material.
Was there interest among these groups?
Oh, yeah.
For a Germanist to come into their area?
Actually, it's quite interesting. German culture, German economics, German politics play a huge role in Northern Africa, particularly in Egypt, but probably also in Jordan and Israel, because they have great interests, economic interests. Siemens, the German corporation, is very big in Egypt. There are lots of schools that teach German, immersion schools, kindergartens. There's a university just in German. There are high schools just in German. So I talked actually once for 3 hours to a group of high school students preparing for study in Germany, and completely in German, and they have to pass really their language level, and they did beautifully. So a high level of competence, I would almost say, to a higher level than some of our students here.
Let's talk a little bit about tolerance. This is something that you lectured on during your time over in Egypt.
Yeah, this is one of the big topics that I pursue all the time. First of all, because I try to be a tolerant person. So I live and breathe as much as I can as a tolerant person. Of course, we all have our shortcomings. But I try to bring the whole idea of tolerance as a discourse, as something that we learn, that we have to practice all the time, and that always challenges each individual, but from a literary historical perspective. So I brought that to students. I lectured several times on this topic to a very diverse audience, and it was very well received, I must say. Yeah.
But the culture itself, some might call it a police state. How did you find living in Cairo? I've been to Cairo, and I remember it as demolition derby, the way the people drive. But some of your thoughts about the whole kind of the political situation with
it's a little bit of tough, touchy issue, yeah. So I have to be careful in how to judge the situation. But we have to keep in mind that currently there is a military government under President el-Sisi. It was a military coup d'etat and against Morsi, the previous president, in 2011. And there was the Muslim Brotherhood. So there is a very deeply seated fear of the Muslim radicals and fanatics. But that was only what I heard. So I didn't quite feel it personally, except I saw soldiers and guards everywhere. Within our little area where we lived, maybe just walking 5 minutes, we saw probably 20 soldiers with their guns and everything. Everywhere, soldiers everywhere, standing guard 24 hours, 7 days a week. So a great fear of any potential danger.
Is there a book in this for you, the research work you're doing?
Yes, there was my other part. I was working on German text from about 1350. 1350, imagine that. Somebody whose name we don't know, who lived for about 12 or 14 years in that region. He was obviously in Cairo, and he wrote extensively about the local conditions. And so part of my research and raison d'être there was, where did he go? Visiting the mosques, looking at the citadel, and understanding really the local situation so that I could translate that middle, low German text into a modern English.
Mm.
And so I accomplished that goal.
You did. Wow.
Yes.
Must have been quite a task, kind of that.
Not easy.
That, that old German language, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a little bit about your newest book, The Secret in Middle Medieval Literature. Can you tell us what is the secret?
Well, there is not the secret, but the realization, as we find it many times expressed in lots of different medieval texts, that life itself is a secret, and that life is sort of on a path, and we are going on this path and trying to figure out our own existence, but that many times there are things that we just do not comprehend. And I think that is a realization that applies even to our own lives. We live in a very rational, very mechanistic world, but at the same time, there are lots of things we just don't understand, whether it's love, whether it's death, whether it's God or whatever you might believe in, but certain things that just happen, but you don't quite know why. Certain circumstances, relationship with people, somebody suddenly showing up, making connections. And so then the question is, why? And who has driven this? Who has caused this misfortune on you? Who has given you that fortune? All kinds of questions which we sort of have pushed aside in our own lives because we live in such a technocratic world, whereas the medieval poets bring it out and just simply present to us, well, we just don't know. We just don't know. And so it's an extremely healthy approach on maybe studying life through that lens, understanding that we just don't know.
You are the editor-in-chief of the Humanities Journal. This is an online journal. I believe it's based in Switzerland. Can anyone access this, or do you have to be a member?
This is an expression or a manifestation of the changes in scholarship and in publishing, because the authors who want to publish have to pay a huge publication fee, but then everything is free. So access is free. And this is a journal where we have lots of different scholars from many different fields, geography and political science, psychology, medicine, then literature, but all sort of trying to address humanistic issues.
And humanities covers pretty much from everything from A to Z. Is that pretty accurate?
Well, that is one of the problems. What do the humanities really mean?
Yes.
So that's the same question our own college here struggles with. And I have simply a very, very firm anchor. It has to be something connected with literature, with the fine arts, with poetry, with maybe philosophy. Once it turns completely to history or completely to psychology, I have to say, no, that's not our field.
More with Dr. Claassen next Thursday at noon here on the Buckmaster Show. Always a pleasure to see you. I hope it's a great holiday season, and we'll look forward to our next conversation talking a little bit about the future. And that seems very appropriate as we close down 2022 and look forward to a happy and healthy 2023. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And very fitting, because we're moving from the past to the present, and now we need to move forward. Need the past.
Thanks so much.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
Dine in or take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade, using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com.
As a small business owner, I appreciate the services of a top-notch certified public accountant. That's why Michael C. Flowers of Flowers, Rieger & Associates is the CPA firm of the Buckmaster Show. Michael's a former Small Business Leader of the Year in Tucson. He'll professionally handle all of your accounting needs and tax preparation services. Flowers, Rieger & Associates, 6125 East Grant Road, and on the web, flowersrieger.com.
For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rialto River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100.
Have you always wanted to cruise to Alaska? If that's the case, then you'll only see the tip of the iceberg. At Bon Voyage Travel, we can package the full Alaska experience with a cruise tour. Journey to Denali National Park on glass-domed rail cars. Tour the tundra wilderness and see the northern lights with an expert guide. And of course, relax on your cruise as you enjoy the glaciers up close and personal. Go to bvtravel.com today. Bon Voyage Travel, your Alaska experts.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show, the Winter Solstice Edition, the 21st of December. Still time to pick up some of those beautiful poinsettias from Green Things, 3384 East River Road. Check out also their sister business, Zocalo Village. Beautiful punched tin Christmas trees. There's a few left. Some Talavera pottery that they've actually made into lamps that are really neat. Green Things, AZ.com and ZocaloVillage.com, open every day. They will be starting their 53rd year of business in January. When we do our telephone interviews, our live line is presented by Rincon Ventures, Real Estate and Property Management. Dr. Bruce Dingus is with me in studio, retired director of publications at the Arizona Historical Society. 36 years as a judge of the Southwest Books of the Year competition. He is retiring from that, and well-deserved. Hey, Bruce, how are you?
That's fine, Bill. Good to be here.
36 years. Oh, my goodness. So that was like the first year, right,
it started? It was going for, I don't know what year I came in, but I think I came in maybe 8 or 10 years after it started.
Hey, before you give us a couple of book suggestions, and you've got a half dozen, so we'll have to really tear through it, but I think this is an appropriate time to mention my friend Tom Miller.
Yeah,
passed away this week. I had Tom in a telephone interview for about 10 minutes. He had just published kind of his memoirs. I think we talked in September, but anyway, he'd been battling for at least 10 years Parkinson's. Yeah, but Tom had some very interesting books.
Yeah,
Panama Hat Trail. Yeah, some good ones.
Yeah, he was at it for a long time. I'll mention, too, Richard Shelton passed away a couple of weeks ago, too. I was going to end up with that. But if you buy one book this Christmas, go out and buy Going Back to Bisbee, which is just a classic, and give it to every friend that's never been here and remind yourself of why we live here.
Yep, Going Back to Bisbee. All right, let's hear some of your picks.
All right, I'll say first a disclaimer. This isn't a best book list. We're flooded with them right now.
No.
These are really the most interesting books I've read in the past year, and the ones that I've been recommending to friends. The first one is Cormac McCarthy, The Passenger, Stella Morris. It's a boxed 2-volume set. I'm an unabashed McCarthy fan. I think he's probably the great novelist, American novelist of the last half century. Author Blood Meridian, No Country for Old Men, The Road. He hasn't published a book in 16 years. Now at the age of 89, in these companion novels, he tackles big questions of life and death in an insensitive world. The Prisoner, the first volume, is a salvage driver roams the Gulf Coast, haunted by the past and pursued by mysterious men. Stella Morris is his sister's journal of her descent into insanity. And in both these books, McCarthy's protagonist just debates topics from God to morality to mathematics, quantum physics, the Kennedy assassination. It's just heavy stuff. But McCarthy's dialogue just jumps off the page, just keeps you reading and reading. One of the big surprises about this is if you're old enough, you'll remember Jim Anderson, legendary bar owner in Tucson. Jim shows up in this book.
Really?
And his bar someplace else. I'm really curious to see how he and Cormac McCarthy crossed paths, but it was an interesting surprise. For history buffs, H.W. Brands, The Last Campaign, Sherman, Geronimo, and the War for America. Brands is a 2-time Pulitzer Prize finalist, and he has an incomparable talent for bringing the past to life. In this case, it's the America's so-called Indian Wars, which he frames as a clash between settlers moving west and resisting Native peoples. He makes a really, really great use of skillful contemporary documents from both Native Americans and Anglo antagonists. It just brings the book to life. Expressing their views, right or wrong, readers come away with a really nuanced and full portrait of how the West was won and lost.
All right, that's two. Three if you count Back to Bisbee.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then for mystery lovers, Leo Banks, .45 caliber perfume.
Local guy.
Yeah, a corrupt Phoenix politician, the young campaign worker with whom he's having an affair, and a wife with connections to the Boston mob are the toxic characters that fuel this neo-noir thriller from the former Tucson Weekly columnist.
Banks's first effort, The Double Wide, garnered numerous awards. In this third book, Banks hits his stride with snappy dialogue, fascinating characters, intriguing plot twists that keep readers glued to the page down to the conclusion. I think it rests comfortably alongside Raymond Carver and James M. Cain and Dashiell Hammett and others who made this made a living off the hard-boiled crime novel. My favorite guilty pleasure, this one, Bill knows, I just came back from a long trip. This was my companion, Jan Wenner, Like a Rolling Stone, a memoir. The founding editor of Rolling Stone magazine takes us on a wild ride through three decades of American popular culture. Wenner's an unabashed name dropper, but God, the names he drops. John Lennon and the Beatles, Jackie Kennedy, the Rolling Stones, Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, and particularly Hunter Thompson, who was prone to stealing typewriters after he finished a piece at Rolling Stone. Scores of musicians and journalists who bore witness to an era. It's a compulsive page-turner, perfect for holiday travel.
Before you continue with your next pick, your next suggestion, I had a listener who loves Barbara Kingsolver's new novel. I think it's called
Demon Copperhead.
Demon Copperhead, yeah, is the new book.
And I was going to mention that. I will now. I haven't read it yet, but it's the next on my list. It's a retelling of Charles Dickens's David Copperfield, but she places it in West Virginia. It's a story of institutionalized poverty, opiate crisis in, say, modern-day Appalachia. It's been an Oprah pick. It was just selected as the New York Times, one of the New York Times' 10 best books of 2022, so I'm anxious to get my hands on that.
Okay, do you have any others?
Jim Harrison, The Search for the Genuine, nonfiction, 1975 to 2015 for nonfiction fans. Harrison, you probably know, spent his winters in Patagonia.
Yeah.
He's one of America's most gifted writers in every genre, poetry, fiction, nonfiction. In this collection of essays, some of them published here for the first time, he ruminates on love and literature, hunting and fishing, border life, and the magic place. Luis Orea, who we all know, contributes to the introduction. I had some part in this because I was at this event, but he met Luis met Harrison on a panel devoted to Chuck Bowden at the 2015 Tucson Festival of Books. Here he pays tribute to Harrison's untamed appetite for what he calls experience, literature, good food, dogs, and unruly rivers. We had a great dinner down at Llanos after the festival that year. It was just kind of a magical moment.
Where's he living now, Harrison?
Harrison passed away.
He did?
Okay. Maybe 2 years ago.
Okay.
Not long after this.
I still miss our mutual friend, Chuck Bowden.
Don't we all? I think of him a lot, too.
And this would be an appropriate time to throw out a suggestion, Bruce Dingus, for those maybe people have heard, maybe some young people, maybe they've heard of the legendary Chuck Bowden. What would be a good entry-level book for a Bowden Bowden fan?
This is totally self-serving, but yes. I would give Bill Broyles and my edition of America's Most Alarming Writer a collection of essays by several dozen friends and admirers of Chuck's, published by the University of Texas Press.
Okay, so those folks may have not heard the whole list. Would you mind going over it again? The title and the author, please.
Yeah. Cormac McCarthy. Mm-hmm. This is a box set, The Passenger, and the other one is Stella Norris, mm-hmm. second volume. Barbara Kingsolver, Demon Copperhead. Jan Wenner, Like a Rolling Stone, a memoir. H.W. Brand's The Last Campaign, Sherman, Geronimo, and the War for America. Jim Harrison, The Search for the Genuine, nonfiction, 1975 to 2015. And Leo Banks, 45 caliber perfume. And go to U of A Press and buy a copy of Going Back to Bisbee.
Mm-hmm. Leo Banks, is that his second or third?
It's his third.
His third already.
Leo's a great writer. He was great on the Weekly, and he's mm-hmm. really found a niche now as a fiction writer.
You know, going back to the book about the Indian Wars,
mm-hmm.
yeah, that what period of time would that cover then? The post-Civil War.
Post-Civil War, and despite the title, it's not specifically Arizona. It's the entire West, Brands is a professor at the University of Texas, and he's just got a spectacular way of making history just come alive in the characters.
All right, Dr. Bruce Dingus, always a pleasure. And Bruce, for folks that don't know, has been involved, he was involved for 36 years as one of the judges for the Southwest Books of the Year competition. He's going to turn over the judging to other people this year, right?
Right.
Yeah. Bruce, retired director of publications at the Arizona Historical Society. Bruce, I hope you and yours have a lovely holiday season.
Same to you, Bill. Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a break right here. Historian Ken Scoville is coming up.
Tucson's original gastropub, Noble Hops in Oro Valley, proudly announces a second Tucson area location where you'll enjoy locally brewed craft beer and gastropub fine fare. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies, on West Lambert Lane at North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley, and now at the Doubletree Hotel on Alvernon across from Tucson's Reed Park. More on the web at noblehops.com.
At Tucson International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We're also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
Delivering a $2 billion voter-approved regional transportation plan involves complex policy, legal, and financial matters. The Regional Transportation Authority is open to answering any questions you have about delivery of the current RTA 20-year plan or about the development of a new regional transportation plan for the next 20 years. Contact the RTA at info@rtamobility.com. Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary, home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org. The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
Welcome back. It is Buckmaster. First day of winter, winter solstice. Got kind of a holiday show going on here today. And speaking of the holidays, many of you will have a few days off. How about maybe a road trip? Hit the road. Jump in the truck. Jump in the car. Take a three-hour drive east of Tucson to Silver City and Grant County, New Mexico. Our friends over there are going to welcome you with open arms. Very tourist-friendly. Lots to do. Outdoor activities. Just check out some of the great Victorian architecture. in downtown Silver City. And if you are into museums, I love museums. The museum at Western New Mexico University, which is based in Silver City, has the finest collection of Mimbrace pottery in the world. So there's something to make the trip to Silver City for. Visit southwestnewmexico.org before you hit the road. Some great tips on what to do and where to stay and even where to eat. There's some great restaurants as well over there. Keeping with our kind of holiday show on the Buckmaster program, let's welcome historian Ken Scoville, one of our regular contributors. And Ken was assigned by me, Mr. Buckmaster. Hey, Ken, how did Christmas start? First of all, hey, happy holidays, Ken.
Happy holidays. I just think, and this is an area that I did some research in, and truthfully, I didn't know as much as I hopefully learned a little bit along the way. Did everything really evolve from the idea of celebrating the winter solstice that we're talking about today? And I think for context, if you're thinking about 1,000 years ago, because celebration of this day meant so many to people because it's a life of darkness. Before electric lights, before gas lamps, the only illumination you would have would be a fire. And so this idea of celebrating that we're going to finally have more sun, we're going to have a growing season because everything really started with agriculture, unless you go back to hunters and gatherers. So there were always these celebrations for the winter solstice. And then, and probably one that most people would recognize was this Yule Scandinavian tradition where they would bring in a huge log and burn it in the fireplace. And this was sort of representing the birth of new animals that could be harvested and slaughtered. And typically the wine was finally fermented or beer fermented by that time. So this was just all a big celebration.
Well,
and
that,
then when you get...
I was going to say that's where we get that saying, throw the Yule log on the fire, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Our history celebrations today are just replete with so many things that have been picked up along the way.
Well, and of course, there is this controversy about when Jesus was born. And I guess, unfortunately, the Bible doesn't mention the date of his birth. Some speculated might have been in the spring. Otherwise, why would shepherds be herding in the middle of winter?
Right. I think from an historian standpoint, there's a really good fact to think about common sense that it wouldn't have happened during the winter because the shepherds wouldn't be out there. But how this sort of evolved is the fact that we have these big winter solstice celebrations, and essentially the church and some of the popes at the time all thought, well, everybody likes to celebrate. Why don't we come up with a date, the 25th of December? And there were also, because we're talking so many different eras, Rome had certain celebrations on the 25th. So they figured, why don't we borrow and pick this date, but then try to eliminate the pagan aspects of it and make this the day of celebrating the birth of Jesus Christ because he was the light of the world. So that was part of that connection to come up with the 25th. But I think from a historian standpoint, it would obviously have been a different time. But if you understand the winter solstice and what was going on in history at that time in the world, you can understand the 25th.
Well, some of these celebrations were kind of Mardi Gras-like, to say the least.
Yes, it became an excuse to go get drinking. And I think the one, and I'm going to bring this up, I looked up eggnog. Everybody loves eggnog.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to read very quickly. This is what George Washington's recipe was for eggnog that he would have every Christmas celebration up in Mount Vernon. And of course, George Washington, his favorite recipe was a bit heavy on the spirits. He went 1 quart of cream, 1 quart of milk, 12 eggs, 1 pint of brandy, 1/2 pint of rye, 1/4 pint of rum, and 1/4 pint of sherry.
Oh, my.
So I meant all mixed together, and that was what he was serving. So you can imagine conversation was pretty lively.
Yeah, I don't think folks would be really ready to open many packages under the tree. Yeah. And then, of course, the whole thing about Santa Claus, that legend going back to Turkey, actually.
Right. And you have to think about Santa Claus. If you remember the one little fragment that really started, have the children been naughty or nice? Because there's been different variations of St. Nick from St. Nicholas and the Dutch situation and where that came from. But in Germany, Santa Claus sort of, if you can believe this, teamed up with the devil. And they would actually punish kids that were bad. And there were some early cards of this and everything. But finally, we would get the kinder and gentler Santa that we think of from, you know, the night before Christmas.
When was the first image, kind of this iconic version of Santa Claus as kind of the jolly man in red and white beard? I'm just wondering, how far back does that go, Ken Scoville?
This is about into the 1880s. There's a very famous political cartoonist, Thomas Nast, that ended up drawing the classic image with the twinkle in the eye and the red outfit. So from the 1880s, and then Santa Claus, and one other thing for the guests, realizing that there had to be an evolution from the wild drinking and parties of Christmas to making it much more of a family event. And we can sort of credit in the United States for really making it a little bit more of a family event that it embraced around the world. And then the Christmas trees would actually come in from England. At one time, they were considered pagan, but Queen Victoria really liked Christmas trees, so she told everybody Christmas trees are fine, and then we adopted it in this country.
And no, Coca-Cola did not invent the modern image of Santa Claus.
No, they stole it. But
hey, I want to bring this to Tucson and the old Pueblo, and we had some people recently, some friends we're talking who've been around for a long time, like you and I have, who remember actually the good old days of Christmas shopping in downtown Tucson, when the big department stores, Steinfeld's, Hockamy's, really went all out, Ken, and the window decorations, and folks went downtown. You know, post World War II, that was the place to do your Christmas shopping.
Yes, it was the real heyday era up to about 1960, 1959, 1960. In fact, one other quick thing to show you how important Christmas and shopping was for downtown, Harold Steinfeld approached Mr. Hockamy and said, "We're going to build you a new store right across the street from us. So you move over so we can compete against each other, and then we'll draw all the traffic over to our two stores so we'll both do better." And then they did cross promotions with Christmas time too, the storefronts, the events, and everything. Because again, Mr. Steinfeld, being the businessman, Albert was his father, Harold was his son. He knew the early idea of grouping all the businesses together like a mall today that we did what that era. But they knew of bringing everybody together in a spot was good for business.
Yeah, because if you're at one of the stores and you walk outside, hey, let's go next door. Or across the street.
And compare prices.
And check it out. Then, of course, Elkhorn Mall came along and kind of maybe the death knoll. Maybe it was the death knoll of downtown. Well, some say it was.
Sure.
Yeah.
But full cycle again, how the competition is with online versus malls, and they're repurposing walls.
Yeah.
So it's a cyclical deal.
All right, Ken Scoville, it's always a pleasure to hear from you. We very much appreciate you. We thank you for your service to the show, and I hope you and yours enjoy this holiday season. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you, and that goes for me and all your listeners. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much. Always a pleasure to hear from Ken. That'll do it for this kind of holiday edition of the Buckmaster Show. We'll be back at it tomorrow. In about, 23 hours, I guess, we'll do the Buckmaster Show all over again. Dave Ramsey is coming up with his very popular show talking about money. All right. On behalf of Tom Fairbanks, on the other side of the glass, Bill Buckmaster saying, hope you have a great afternoon.